The Home Show with Sinead Ryan on News Talk.
Hello and welcome along to the Home Show podcast. My name is Sinead Ryan. This is News Talk's pod about homes, housing, interiors and architecture. Coming up on this episode, well, the Rotunda Hospital has been in the news this week for political reasons. We're going to take a peek inside the beautiful buildings that are our maternity hospitals. Our DIY series with News Talk presenters continues with Susan Hayes-Culleton on the economics of doing it yourself. Foodie Russell Alford on creating a posh picnic and Jenny Sheehan on the bunk bed revival. If you'd like to get in touch with us on the Home Show pod, you can find us at thehomeshow@newstalk.com and you'll find me on Instagram, SineadRyan100. Now, the Rotunda Hospital in the heart of Dublin witnesses the birth of 8,500 babies every single year, making it their first home. It's been in the news recently now for political reasons, but we're going to take a look inside one of Dublin's most beautiful buildings. And joining me to discuss it is architect and artist Roisin Murphy. Welcome back to the show.
Lovely to be here, Sinead.
This is undeniably a beautiful building and it gets its name from
The Rotunda,
which, yes, for people who don't know, is the dome-like structure on the top of the building.
Excellent. Perfect.
See, that's pretty much now the end of my knowledge on the topic. But I sound confident.
That's also because of the round building itself. You know,
okay.
It's not just the Rotunda. It's also the Rotunda, the form of that building as you go up to...
Give us a little bit about the history. Were you born in the Rotunda? Were your
kids born
in the Rotunda?
I was born in one of those ridiculous... my mother is a midwife, first of all, so I've got skin in the game here.
Oh, right.
And my mother... but she trained in the Rotunda and she told me that they were told at the time, because it wasn't run by women who'd had babies, it was, you know, the nuns run the place. And I'm not disparaging the nuns, but they were told there was no such thing as labour pain. So my mum went in to have her first baby. And so there was supposed to be a hysterical reaction by women to birth. And she was like, what the hell is this? So she then went directly to any nursing home. I think I was born in, where's the one that's on the south side that's very nice?
That Mount Carmel.
I was born in Mount Carmel.
Yeah,
I was born in Mount Carmel with access for lots of what. And this is the thing, when I was looking at the history of maternity care, singularly comes up is pain management. Yeah. The reason we go to these places is for pain management. But the Rotunda is absolutely fascinating because it was started by a guy called Richard Moss, his first wife and child died in childbirth. Okay, so in the 1750s, he established. He went to work in Europe, and there was wars at the time in Central Europe, and he was apparently an absolutely brilliant surgeon, and very interested in, obviously because his wife and child had died in childbirth, very interested in maternity care. He ended up in Paris working in the Hotel Charité. Apologies for that pronunciation, which is just beside Notre Dame, which was a kind of a big, huge hospital that had a maternity wing. And this is the distinction between what happened with the Rotunda. So he came back. The first maternity hospital was actually really for charity. It was considered for homelessness, for people to have babies in sheltered accommodation.
From tenements, from the very poor people.
From the street,
people.
From everything. Yeah. And there was the famine had happened. I mean, Dublin was a very different place because when the famine happened, there was an influx of people into the city to look for food, to look for care. So it was teeming with social issues. So it was a charitable thing to help people have birth, particularly in relation to the famine. And it was in Deckwells on Georgia Street, was the actual first maternity hospital.
Deckwells, the hardware shop.
Okay. I'm sure you could get forceps there. You could probably get a forceps in Deckwells. Anyway, so then they moved across. They bought this plot of land on the other side of the Liffey, where they were establishing the kind of Georgian quarter at the time. And it came at exactly the same time as they established Parnell Square as well. So those two buildings grew up hand in glove, which is very interesting in terms of the politics. I'm not going to get into it. But so it originally, that site was originally there from about the 10th century, where it was a burial ground for the Battle of Clontarf, apparently. Anyway, that's down another rabbit hole. So Richard Castle designed the first Rotunda, that complex of buildings, and he raised money for it by establishing what they call as the pleasure gardens, which is a lovely phrase, isn't it?
For women in labour.
No, yeah, well, the pleasure garden. No, you know, the gardens they go to visit to raise money. So the idea was that Georgian society would come to the north inner city, they all had like North Great George Street, all of those grand houses were being developed. But the idea was you'd no Instagram, you'd no telly, you'd no radio. So likewise, you went out to coffee shops to read newspapers, but also you paraded around the place.
Yeah. Like and just to show off your horses and your wealth and your costumes and all that kind of thing.
Okay. And so they established that garden. I think you paid into it and they had the pillar room to raise money to establish this hospital.
The design of the building is incongruous to some extent with what was going on in the rest of Dublin at that time. Was that deliberate? Did they want something very striking, or did Castles just decide, I'm just going to have fun here and build, you know, it's nearly Italianish in its.
I think he had done Leinster House, so he was of that ilk. You know, it was all about that. They were all going to Europe. They were all bringing ideas back. And I suppose it was that sort of notions. But also, I mean, to be honest with you, it's the commodification of female stuff, right? So there was also the burgeoning idea of monitoring childbirth. Mm. So up to that point, say, childbirth had been handled by midwives. And I mean, there was a lot of struggle there between, it was considered unseemly for people to go and assist in, it wasn't part of the male domain in surgery. Mm. And then they started to assist in posh women's labours. Mm. So they were going, there's money in this, lads. So then I think it's very much, but I don't think Moss or Castles were driven. I think Moss was an incredibly religious character. He insisted on a church being integrated into this building, and it has this very funny kind of little tower, a minaret kind of, like, so it's definitely manifesting as a symbol of kind of care and health, I suppose, and empowerment of healthcare in the management of female birthing.
Yeah.
But also he was innovative in the sense that he reduced, having worked in Paris, he reduced the size of the wards. So the wards went from being huge rooms.
Yeah, these industrial kind of long wards that you see in photographs sometimes.
Exactly. Yeah. So that reduced illness. So there was a kind of a knowledge base there. And in fairness to, I know Holles Street is there as well. Mm. Holles Street did the same thing. They discovered through the management of rooms and reduction of people in rooms that it reduced illness and maternity.
And infection and things. Yeah. Cross infection and that. Well, now you've mentioned Holles Street.
Yeah.
And I have a soft spot for Holles Street.
Because we're talking about this. You had your babies in Holles Street, didn't you?
I had my babies
in the Rotunda. Award-winning babies come from the Rotunda. You too, and things like that.
But Holles Street is an entirely different building.
Yes.
It's a different time, maybe, or a different era. I personally think it's an absolutely beautiful building. And the reasons are because we've spoken many, many, many times on my lack
deco,
of architecture. I love
Lana
the symmetry.
Del Rey here.
I love the symmetry. I love all the windows looking the same, being in the same place, and that kind of block. You're not mad about this structure, but it is a beautiful building inside.
I absolutely cannot believe how little affection I have for Holles Street. Just physically, the way it appears in the street, it's a neo-Georgian Art Deco-y sort of building.
They're all good words.
And it's mentioned in Ulysses, my favourite architectural activist tome, and he has that chapter, which apparently is really laborious. It's coming up to Bloomsday, so just a shout out to anybody who's celebrating Bloomsday. He has Oxen of the Sun as the chapter that's centred around Holles Street and where the baby's born and everything. Apparently it's pure trudgery to get through to it, but I found it really interesting reading it, because in the book you can really feel the compression of Holles Street in comparison. Like the Rotunda occupies a block. It's like one of those, it's very equivalent to a French kind of opera, whereas Holles Street is very English. It's very proper. It sits on the street. It has a kind of facade that doesn't reveal anything about it. But do you know what I mean? It's just like, we're here, we have a pediment, we have a couple of steps up. And I did a building years ago for O'Connor Sutton Cronin. Sinead O'Connor's dad was an engineer, and we had an office building. We wanted to put a little bit of neon. They said, oh, you can't do that. It would disturb the ladies in labour. So it's all very proper. Holles Street is no mess. Yeah. Where we Conway's on the other side of the Rotunda, where everybody was drinking drunkenly. But anyway, It was originally a collection of Georgian buildings that were interconnected.
Ah,
and that's what we're
that
listening to.
That explains a lot.
Yes.
Okay, because when you're in it,
yeah.
it bears no relationship to the outside, which is very, as you say, structured, proper. You look as if things you're going to go in and everything will be ordered
inside.
It's not ordered. It's not ordered.
No.
The staircases go in a range of directions. Now, they are beautiful staircases. They have these wide banisters. Anybody who's laboured up and down those stairs will know about it and up and down the corridors. They're kind of, they're dented and the walls go in funny directions.
And you feel that in Ulysses, in Oxen of the Sun. Anybody who's had a baby in, and I would say this as well, because we said this on the book, the bookshelf with Kira, that it, you get that sense of oppression in Oxen of the Sun. You don't need to be a big intellectual, because I could feel that compression from the book. You feel them in the waiting room, and they're drinking in one of the waiting rooms as well. It brings that sense. And maybe that's why the Rotunda, at an extent, is built for purpose. It was a site.
Yes.
So it was never kind of an adaptation of buildings. Both of these buildings, and particularly the Rotunda, is the very first maternity hospital ever. A hospital dedicated to the care and management of women. Like, you know, you're not going into an ER or a hospital.
Well, listen, long may both buildings last. They are beautiful, both of them. And, you know, it's so important that our women are cared for no matter where they're giving birth. My thanks to Roisin Murphy for that fascinating insight.
The Home Show on News Talk. The Home Show on News Talk.
53106 if you want to get in touch. It is The Home Show and I am Sinead Ryan with you till the top of the hour. Now, we haven't had a great run of it this week, and weather permitting, there is nothing that says summer more than a picnic. But forget the ham sandwiches and the flat fizz. This is The Home Show and we only insist on the best. Here to give us his take on what makes a posh, perfect picnic is one half of the Gastrogaze, Russell Alford.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Are you a picnic fan? I suspect you should. You are.
I am. I just don't get the opportunity enough to enjoy a picnic. Anytime I do, I have the best time and I love planning it. But, it, you know how it is. Sometimes it's hard to get everyone in a room, but never mind a park together. So, you know, there are always nice little occasions. But the weather, especially this week, has not been very inspiring.
No. So we're going to be hopeful.
Yes.
Because it has been lovely in that bit that was summer.
That day. Yeah, it was lovely. Yeah.
And hopefully we'll get nice weather again. And I know that all the, like, across the water, you've got Royal Ascot and, you know, all these events are on and picnics are the order of the day. I was in London last weekend and I couldn't resist doing a Fortnum and Mason tour, and on the very top floor they have a whole floor, I kid you not, dedicated to picnics.
Yes.
Picnic baskets and beautiful things.
When I lived in London, that was all I ever wanted to be sent, was a Fortnum and Mason basket, and it never happened. I'm so disappointed.
Yeah. So the first elements. Now, the first thing we need is a picnic basket.
Yes.
Now, you've been having a little look around about what's available, and what do you think are the good elements in a picnic basket?
So you absolutely need to, with your basket, you need your blanket. You need something to sit on. No one really wants to sit on grass and get those little indentations into your hand and into your finger while you're trying to eat. So a nice blanket. Of course, Ireland has great crafts when it comes to wool and different materials. I love Foxford out in Mayo.
We had Helen McAlinden in last week, and she is responsible for designing a lot of the throws and blankets there. So
they are
beautiful.
Absolutely beautiful. Now, always with these things, the price tag is high. It's over 100 quid, you know, 130, 170.
They're heirloom pieces though, aren't they?
Precisely. You pay for quality, buy once, last forever. I have a beautiful, it was a Michael Collins tribute throw that I got as a present. God, it must have been about 10 years ago.
A
and
Republican
it's still.
Picnic. Excellent.
Is it exactly. And it looks well at the green of the grass, but it's a beautiful piece and I treasure it because I have it so long and it's in good condition. Whereas, you know, if you go for something a bit more cheaper and cheerful, it will do the job, but it might wear and tear a bit more.
How do you feel about a fabric design that I don't like in any other capacity except on a picnic blanket, and that's tartan?
Oh, I thought you were going to say gingham there, which is very bake-off. I'm a big fan of tartan. I think it's very elegant, and it has its place and it has its charm. I think you'd be wanting to have an iron brew potentially to enjoy the Scottish nature of it alongside
indeed.
It, if you're having that as a fizz.
My own picnic blanket is a green tartan with kind of gold squares on it. Beautiful. And I use it sometimes when my niece and nephews are over, the smallies. and we spread it out in the sitting room and let them have an indoor picnic on it, and they feel kind of special. It's just we don't want them at the adult table.
Exactly. Good excuse.
It's not altruistic.
Exactly.
Okay, so picnic baskets. Now, what have you found? Because these used to be everywhere and they were kind of my go-to wedding gift for people, a stuffed picnic basket. But they're hard enough to find nowadays.
They are. Now, when you asked for bougie, I decided to find the bougiest one possible. Just as a little example there, and again, my aspirations would love to get this. This is a 6,000 euro one, £5,000 Connolly, England. Beautiful brand. It's a luxury leather one. It's handmade in France, finished in Spain. Has green leather on the handles. It has beautiful plates. It has a drawer for your champagne bottle. Not
what picnic basket doesn't, Russell?
Exactly, you need a basket for it. So, you know, your 3 for 12 sausage roll might look really good in this as you're going around the picnic. But in a more attainable manner, the fantastic Carrick Dunn, they have two kind of versions. One starting just below 100 quid, which is the perfect little fold-up basket with floral design on the inside. Obviously, there's no cooling mechanism or anything like that, but it does the job. You can keep your stuff safe. It looks very elegant to walk along with. But then if you need all the cutlery and the accoutrement, of course, the Delf end of things is quite nice. Having some proper cutlery.
Isn't it? Yeah. And not plastic plates.
Absolutely not. The plastic, and of course we can go on about plastic as well, but I don't mind a wooden or bamboo plate myself, but I have a problem with the cutlery. I don't like the feeling of it on my teeth. So I'd rather have some reusable cutlery or some from home. Which and cutlery? There's a lot of these that match the set, match the design that are available. There's a nice one also in Carrick Dunn, 150 or thereabouts for it. And you know, as
that's
you say,
not bad now.
A lovely gift.
Yeah.
A very useful thing to have in storage, and a nice little plaything as well. If you're giving someone a hamper as well, you can add a few extra bits into it, a few presents, a few crisps or whatever, you know, if you're doing a housewarming or a wedding present, you know. Very
fantastic.
Nice.
Okay, so lots of choice there, picnic baskets. Now talk to me, I think nowadays, if most people were heading to the beach for a picnic or a park, they might bring a water cooler bag.
Yes,
you know,
those
kind of padded things that you can, and there's a lot of sense in those.
And these are the technology that's coming along with these are amazing. Like right now, there's two kind of brands that are kind of three really who are doing very well. Stanley, of course, because of Stanley Cups. Yeah. Yeti. I have a Yeti jug here of water. I used to be chronically dehydrated until I got this, and now I drink so much water it's obscene. But their coolers, these are wheelable ones, great if you're going camping. But you do see people coming on the beach with them, dragging them along, filled
great
with food.
Great idea
and
to have them on
bits.
Like a little trolley. Yeah,
exactly. And now these come at quite a high price. The smaller ones about 150, the bigger ones about 45 litres. You're talking close to near 400 euro for them, but they are timeless. They have a great guarantee on them, and they do a great job storing the materials for hours, days in some cases. But Ninja as well.
The air fryer people.
Exactly. Look to the experts. They do a backpack that is a soft cooler, so you're not dragging it along as much like that.
So do you look like a fella from like Just Eat?
a little bit, but it's a bit more compact. What's amazing about this is it has a dry section underneath. So it has the wet section where you essentially put all your cool stuff, and then there's a section underneath where it will be cool, but it won't be touching any ice elements, and it can keep sandwiches and other bits and bobs cold without becoming soggy. It's very handy.
Wow. Okay, and what price is that then?
There's a few varieties. The 17 litre one's about 240 euro.
Okay.
Or so.
Yeah. Okay, so it's an investment piece. I mean, you don't know how much use you're going to get out of it. That's part of the problem.
No, but if you think about it, if you use it for anything, from if you're going to the beach for a day, you're doing a picnic, you're going camping, you're at a festival, if you're going to a nice cabin or anything like that, there's a lot of uses. Yeah. Or even if you're just going on a long journey and you're dropping into the butcher's before you go down, pop it in there and your steak is nice and chilled.
Fantastic.
By the time you get
home. Now, a couple of must-haves and top tips. If you're going to be posh with your picnic, then there's certain things you have to do. And I know one of them, one of your kind of ideas, and it's a very good one, is if you're bringing anything salad-y, that you dress it at the picnic.
Absolutely. Bring the dressing separately. You know, I think we try to make everything as convenient as possible. You know, if you think about it, if you go to a supermarket and you buy a salad bowl, the dressing is always going to be separate. So apply the same logic to your salad when you're bringing it. So use a little reusable jar, make your salad dressing. Ideally, make your salad dressing instead of buying it. It's always a great encouragement for me. and dress it at the location. I find bringing as many, if you have like takeout containers, if you have glass jars, reuse them. The picnics are the perfect excuse to do it. It also looks a little bit more elegant when you have like, you know, your little glass Kilner jars full of things.
Yeah. There's a weight element though there. Like they do weigh more. But
there is, but
they
the kids
do
can
look
carry
prettier.
That. It says hi with no kids.
Useful things. Okay. And you're a fan of less is more. Choose hero ingredients rather than whole mishmash of stuff.
It can be, I keep mentioning it's 3 for 12 type of offers type of thing. I'm a big fan of those kinds of things when it comes to a picnic, but you can fall into a situation where you have a quiche, too many sausage rolls and scotch eggs, and you only eat half of them, depending on how many people. Yeah. If you're just a group of 3 or 4 of you, pick one thing and a lot of smaller bits. So like get a nice quiche or some scotch eggs, pork pies, sausage rolls, and then have the little bits, the dippy bits, you know, your hummus, your tiramisu, if you're very fancy, a couple of crackers, a cheese, just a single cheese slice that you can just go between us. You don't actually eat as much in a picnic as you think you will. Mm. It's not a meal, because chances are a picnic is a social occasion that you do midway through the day, probably still going for dinner later in the afternoon. It's just food to enjoy in the presence of others, as opposed to it being a meal.
The nibbly. Although I do have an unconfirmed scientific fact, which is that you tend to eat more outdoors. I don't know whether it's just like the weather or you're just feeling like, you know, it's an occasion or, you know.
I hear you. I always quote Rick Stein in one of his amazing TV shows, described the seasoning of fresh air as being like salt and vinegar. You know, it's like, it's just fresh air is one of the greatest seasonings you can ever have. And I get that when it comes to a picnic. It's
brilliant.
Fantastic.
Well, on that note, we'll leave it. Russell Alford, GastroGaze, Sunday Times columnist, food writer. And listen, let's hope we get loads and loads of opportunities for a picnic this summer. Now, regular listeners will know we've been running a mini-series this summer with the help of my News Talk colleagues, asking presenters about their DIY skills. Now, so far, we've learned that you can ask Shane Beattie anything, Andrea Gilligan nothing, and Anton Savage regularly tries to kill himself with his DIY tools. Well, this week we have another guest, but I think I'm warned the conversation on the skill set will be brief, but she's a whiz at the sums involved. Susan Hayes Cullerton, the positive economist and presenter of Taking Stock on News Talk. Welcome.
Thank you very much indeed for having me. I'm honoured to be part of this mini-series, Sinead. I have to say, thanks a million.
Well, let's get the skill set out of the way then. On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being Pete the Builder, where do you rank?
Well, I'm going to redefine DIY here now. How about
backpedaling already?
Yes. So when it comes to applying for a mortgage, that I would also call a DIY skill. When it comes to picking stocks and managing your money, when it comes to deciding on a menu for a dinner party that I would subsequently cook, I'm going to do an Anton Savage on this and give myself a 9. However, when it comes to like painting or plastering,
yeah,
or
that's what we're talking about.
I get that. Like, but I didn't want to come in and say a minus 500, Sinead, because that is exactly where any of that, the rest of that stuff goes.
All right. Okay. So that's, we can establish that you don't enjoy it. It's not within your bailiwick, but you've lots of talents in other ways. That's fine. That's okay.
You're so
that's
diplomatic.
Right. We have it.
Yes.
We have it.
Yes, indeed.
Now let's start with what can you do. So where at home something goes wrong, or your shelf needs putting up, or a wall you're bored with. Is your first stance, I'm not touching that, or is it, I'll give it a go?
Oh, I can't even imagine what it's like to be bored with a wall. Like, I cannot. I would love to read what's on the shelf of what's on the wall. But no, I've zero skills when it comes to this. Like, we moved into our house in 2021, and my husband, Ardle, I said to him, I'm very happy for you to pick every colour, pick every everything. Oh, every everything.
Oh, so yeah. You have no interest in it even?
Not a bit. I love going home and see what has changed. Not a bit, Sinead. I'm totally happy with him picking whatever he wants. He's got great taste. Shouldn't he pick me?
That's true.
He's great taste in colours and in all sorts of things like that.
And actually, isn't that the successful bit of that kind of compromise in marriage, where you can just say, because we know from couples we've spoken to on the home show that people fall out over, I want cream, well, I want yellow, I want green, I want blue. And where you devolve it completely to one person and you don't gripe about it afterwards, It usually works out.
It does, and it has worked out really, really well. Like, and actually, as he was picking furniture, various different things like that, people in furniture shops, etc., would say, "Do you want to run that by your wife or anything?" And he'd say, "No, no, no, it's fine." And I really am.
I have to pare this back a bit. Could you change a light bulb?
I can. Yes, I can do that. Like, I can screw it out and screw another one
back
in.
You're saying that with some sense of achievement. So we give it to you. We'll give it to you.
Thank you.
Do you wish that you were able to do these things, or does it just hold so little interest for you that there's always somebody you can get to do it?
Do you know what I love to do is I love to pay people who love what they respectively do.
Okay.
So therefore, I would hate to rob anybody of the pleasure of being able to do
being
so
your
things.
Electrician.
Exactly. So no, I'm okay with the fact that I'm telling you this today. And I know I'm being honest with all of your listeners, but I'm happy with that.
Okay. Well, look, that's very honest. And it's better than have a go and getting it wrong. So, you know, that's absolutely fine, Susan. We'll take you at. Okay, Susan's going to the bottom of our list now very quickly. But she's happy with it. She's happy with it. So that's fine.
Exactly.
All right. Now, there is no doubt, because we're into your bailiwick now, that this, it is a huge market for people with professional skills. Tradespeople, builders, plasterers, electricians, and they are in a boon market. But what, of course, that means in economic terms is that construction inflation is rampant and it's above regular inflation, and we know how high that is at the moment. So this is a market where it is literally the laws of supply and demand.
Well, it is. And Sinead, I listened back to all of my three colleagues and their conversations with you. And, you know, I was thinking about Shane, who saved €30,000 as a result of the work that he did himself. And Anton saying that he had put in the kitchen, and Andrea saying that she had, you know, redesigned the bar in her house. And the thing is, one of the areas that is quite strong today is being able to do that, of course, because of the cost of materials, but also because you really can't find people. Mm. And I think that this is the thing about when, you know, at the time that we're recording this now, where it's leaving cert time over these couple of weeks and people are deciding on what ways to go, the demand for people who are able to do the things that we're talking about and that you've been talking about throughout the series is really, really high. What surprised me is that none of them said how difficult it was to get them. And that points to, in its own right. The second thing though is, construction inflation is really strong, and therefore trying to find people who can come in and do these jobs at a reasonable price also then affects things. So I can completely understand why people go out and say, look, I'm going to do this myself. I'm not waiting 3 weeks or 6 weeks or 9 weeks for somebody. I'm going to go do a few YouTube tutorials. As I say, I'm just not in that competitive market myself.
Do we know how big the DIY market is? I mean, we have huge firms like Woody's, B&Q, who really have a constant stream of people in and out through their doors, very helpful staff, always willing to say, you just need this screw and this gadget here and all of that. It is a massive market. People love their homes and they want them to constantly be changing and doing new things.
Oh, we do, but it's a very broad definition. So the hardware and home improvement stores industry, and that would cover like retail sales of who you were talking about there, it was round about $2 billion in revenue in 2023. Now, these figures can be dependent upon the time that they're recorded and so on like that. So if it was $2 billion back in 2023, Sinead, I would say we could add on 10% on that based on the increase in prices along the way. And then that covers all sorts of things like going and getting your hammers and your nails and so on, or bringing in the people as well who might want to, might be interested in putting all of those things together. And of course, then there's secondary markets around that. Like I've heard in each case as well that you ask people about being able to put an IKEA bookshelf together. And now, of course, IKEA have a secondary offering of where now you can pay people in order to do that.
I will be asking you that question at the end.
And I am going to have a great answer for you.
I know where it's going already. So the consequence of that then, Susan, is that this is a tight market. There's lots of demand, not enough supply. Prices are high. Do you think that we invest enough in creating the next generation of tradespeople? Is there enough apprenticeships and the focus on it? Now, there has been a big push, I think when Simon Harris was kind of third level, when he was in charge of that sector, he had, there's going to be a huge push on apprentices, and we're going to create loads more places. I have a secret theory. And my secret theory is that a lot of this is to do with the Irish mammy. And I have a sense that there is this such a push on going to university, going to college, getting a degree in something, that it can pull people away from what is a very, very valuable work pathway, which is the apprenticeship.
I have the Irish teenager theory on this, of which I have tested out multiple times. first of all, there is a huge prestige around going to college and university. And I think that there is a gap in that when it comes to an apprenticeship. People don't feel it has the same prestige. I think that's changing, but I don't think that it's changing fast enough. Mm. However, when you ask teenagers, of which I've done multiple times, when you ask them whose services or skills or talents do you think will be more in demand upon graduating? Would it be a graduate traditionally, or would it be an apprentice? They always tell me an apprentice. Mm. Then when I say to them, who do you think can earn more? They'll tell me the apprentice. And then I've said to them, how long do you think it would take for the college graduates' earnings to catch up on the apprentice? They say it could take up to 10 years. Now that's Ireland's 16-year-old telling me that. Mm. So, and then I'd say to them, which are you going to likely choose? And they'll tell me university, because they don't want to miss out on the experience. Sure. And what I would also say as well is the problem, going back to Simon Harris's reference that you made there, is that if a company takes on an apprentice, they're basically offering a person a job. So you have to go through the process of hiring somebody. And when I applied for my CAO back when I did, I was a number. So you weren't determining whether I was a good fit, in inverted commas, for a course. But Sinead, you wouldn't do that if I was an apprentice. If I was an apprentice, let's say accounting technician, for example, you'd have to determine whether you wanted me. And then, of course, there is a big upfront cost from companies. I don't mean literal outlay. Mm. There's that as well. But there is, do you want this person to be part of your organisation and spend time and energy in investing in them from an apprenticeship point of view? So it's a rounded conversation. Mm. Do I think there's enough? Absolutely not. No, I don't. But I can understand the complexity of actually making this happen. I think there's a lot more demand than we can see, because if there was more supply of those places, I think we'd see that manifest. But I'd love to see the prestige rising. And just to understand as well, a lot of teenagers don't know that apprenticeships are earn and learn. Mm. They're unaware that you would get paid along the way.
And the payment can be significant enough for a 19-year-old coming out of school. It's a couple of hundred quid a week, and more as you progress through your apprenticeship, and pretty much the guarantee of a job thereafter. So it is a really good way to learn. I came up through the apprenticeship route in my kind of field, which was finance, and I can't speak highly enough of it. Do you think, Susan, that we should be teaching more, like, okay, DIY in this case, but life skills in general in school? And I know teachers have enough to do, and there's a lot in the curriculum currently, but things like cooking, woodwork, you know, being able to kind of wire a plug. These are all things that maybe we should all learn, maybe at the expense of the Oxbow Lake or Hamlet soliloquy. But
I have a slightly alternative theory on this as well. I keep reading, redefining things, and you hear it now, Sinead. When I think of business education in this country, I think we actually do a super job for people who want to get into business through the local enterprise offices. And I would love to see that for life skills. Imagine if it wasn't just you could study this in school or study this in transition year. But imagine if now today, for some reason, I decided that I wanted to learn all the things that I'm telling you that I don't know how to do, is that there would be a place for me to go. And yes, there's a role for the private market in that. But I also think that there would be a role for public funding as well in terms of building those life skills. I absolutely love to cook. I love to cook. And I have gone and done courses, and I've done courses online and so on like that as well. Mm. But it would be wonderful if we could take the model that I think has been rolled out really successfully around entrepreneurship education into life skills education, but not just restricted for younger people, for us all.
For us all. All right. Good. Okay. AI, it's transforming every single industry. This is no different in terms of, I've seen the most amazing, like, 3D models of things and plans for houses and construction and architecture. We're always going to need an electrician or a plumber, aren't we?
Well, we are. And I remember back when we bought the house originally, you was using this AR, augmented reality tool. I think it was from Dulux, where I was holding the camera up to the wall and I was picking out the colour, and then I could see what colour it changed to. And I, in my own opinion, did a great job of that, Sinead. Then I went back to my husband and said, what did you think? And he said, you know what now, Suze? You can leave it with me altogether. So AR or AI wasn't helping me in that regard. But yes, you can't AI your way to having, as you say, fixing a plug or fixing a leak or dealing with the issue that Andrea had spoken about a couple of weeks ago and so on. So this is one of the ways in which you can absolutely, I don't like saying future-proof because we don't know what the future looks like, but I think it can certainly build your resilience in an employment market where there's career ladder erosion of AI.
All right. Well, then, a very positive outlook from the Positive Economist, despite her own lacking in this area. So let me finish then, Susan Hayes-Cullerton, with the question I ask everybody on this slot. Could you put together an IKEA Billy bookcase.
Do you know, I could. And I'll tell you why. You should see her face here, listeners. Oh my God, she's so surprised. I'll tell you why is in the other conversations you had with people, you were talking about the role of maths. And in my case, my degree is financial maths and economics, but it teaches you to be logical. So actually, if you give me a set of instructions, which IKEA does extremely well, I could. Yeah. In fact, between the two of us at home, I'd probably be more likely to be the one to put it together. But picking it, the colour of it, where it would go and all the rest of it, I'm very, very happy to abdicate such decision.
Well, it strikes me then that you'd get the maths bit of it so licked and the whole organisation of it that you probably wouldn't even have screws left over, which is a change for most people who try to put together one of these things. All right. You can hear Susan Hayes Cullen on Taking Stock at 9 a.m. on Sundays and, of course, on podcast. Susan, thanks a million for joining us on The Home Show.
It's been a delight, Sinead. Thanks so much for having me.
The Home Show on News Talk.
Welcome back to Yeah, That's a Pepper Thing. First up, we've got Harrison wrapping his Dr. Pepper in a tiny quilt so it feels at home. Oh, how tender. That's a Pepper Thing. And over to Becca, who's whispering affirmations to her can.
You're sweet. You're unique. You're the best thing I ever poured over ice.
She swears it makes it taste better. It's not a science thing, but it's a Pepper Thing. Why do they all do it? All for that sweet, delicious, truly one-of-a-kind taste of Dr. Pepper. It's a Pepper Thing.
The Home Show on News Talk.
53106 if you want to get in touch. This is The Home Show with me, Sinead Ryan. You're very welcome back. Now, when you're tight on space and kids need room, bunk beds are a brilliant solving problem mechanism. Now, they're fun. They come in lots of shapes and sizes. And returned from her shopping trip for us to tell us what she's found is former Home of the Year winner and show regular Jennifer Sheehan. Welcome back.
Hi.
Bunk beds. Do you like a bunk bed yourself? Would you like, does that inner child come out in you when you see them?
I love them so much. And you know, I was thinking when I was researching this piece, when was the last time I slept in a bunk bed? You know, how young was I? And I think I was about 34 because I remember me and all the girls went on a weekend trip to Budapest not a long time ago. I mean, I'm very young. A few years ago, and we stayed in this kind of, you know, we all had one room together in this hostel. I think there could have been about 10 of us. But they had all these very well laid out bunk beds such that while everybody was in the same room, we all had kind of an individual space. You know, one was on one side of a divider, one was on the other side of a divider.
Okay.
There was curtains going on. It was a very comfortable situation.
So adult bunk beds, I mean, look, it's not a bad idea. And they're certainly cheap when it comes to accommodation abroad and at home. I mean, look, I've had them. I mentioned at the top of the show, my DIY disaster with putting up bunk beds, which I should never have started. But they were just a very ordinary kind. Two single beds, one above the other, and a little wooden ladder with three or four steps up to it. And that's at its most basic. It's very good value and kids love them for a while.
Yeah.
But you've been looking at the much nicer design elements because that's not the only way they come. They can actually be really stylish.
The evolution of the bunk bed. And I think what you're describing, at least you can fit two beds into the space where one bed would normally fit. So you're space saving a bit. But if you invest a bit more and you think a bit more cleverly and you go down a design route, they can be incredible space savers. You can get storage built into them. They can be so fun with slides, and there can be desks underneath and, you know, play areas for the kids to have their friends over and everything. So I think I'm all for it. I think they're phenomenal.
Okay, now you've sent in some, you have some pictures in here of different styles. I must say they look nothing like, you know, the one bed over another that I used to have. You'll have to explain them now for radio.
Right, okay, let me paint you a picture, listener, with my words. So the first one we have up is this beautiful room with a wallpaper pattern, matching curtains, which sounds a bit kitschy, but it's working. And then this beautifully installed, clearly built in. Really everything we're talking about here now is built in. It's bespoke, you know, there's storage in it, etc. So this beautiful yellow, kind of a rich ochre yellow, stairs up one side, drawers built into the other, little dividing curtains, a little matching rail on the top bunk, and the cutest little setup for a little girl's bedroom.
I mean,
how adorable.
This design, which I'm looking at now, it kind of is reminiscent of a posh ship. You know, like, you know, the ferries, when you go to France or whatever on the ferries and you have kind of the bunk beds. So this is like a really posh version of that.
Yeah. And how fun for kids to be getting into that every night, you know. And then the sliding curtains, I think, is key for a bit of privacy.
Isn't
for all of them.
Isn't yeah. it? And actually, yeah. it's nearly reminiscent. We did a piece on, there's a really old plane, one of the first transatlantic planes down in Foynes.
Oh,
in
yeah,
the,
I've seen it.
In the museum. And when I see those planes, because they had berths on them, they had little curtains that just went over the window rather than a blind you pull down.
I mean.
And they are just so cute.
Yeah, that was back okay. when flying was
so this
delight.
Is bespoke, built in.
Bespoke and built in.
So you can pretty much design what you want and the little rail. But actually the colour here is what makes the difference.
Because
you don't think of colouring, painting bunk beds.
You wouldn't think of painting bunk beds. And you know, there's a significant amount of panelling going on here. So it's not just little spindles of, you know, wobbly upper bed. I mean, this is full kind of, you know, built in wardrobe standard panelling.
It's quite American looking, isn't it?
Yeah, I think they all are probably. Yeah. The next one's coming.
Right, what's next?
So next we have a bit of pattern, which I think is... I mean, these to me look like adult bunk beds. And I don't know. I mean, I know we had that one fun weekend in Budapest in my 30s. I don't know what I want to be sleeping in adult bunk beds now. But maybe you're the kind of person who hosts loads, or for example, Christmas. Mm. If you've loads of people home for Christmas and you love having the house full and you don't necessarily want to be putting people on, you know, blow up beds in the living room, maybe your spare room is turned into a bunk bed situation and you can have all the family home. And I think this is what this is. So what we're looking at here, listener, is a much more mature, richer, very, very deep green colour. It's all spindles in a very mature fashion. There's kind of straight lines of a ladder going up to the top bunk beds. There's very, you know, mature adult patterned bedding on the bed with the matching wallpaper.
There's a hint of the old Laura Ashley about that, with that deep green having that muted florals all over the place. And actually, it's not a bad look.
It's working. And then we have some rugs, some animal skin rugs. So there's almost a hint of a lodge situation here, isn't there? Maybe it's your holiday home and you need to, you know, host all the family or whatever it might be. So there's four bunk beds. They look to me adult size single beds, two and two on either side of the room, but incredibly comfortable and stylish, sophisticated.
And indeed, if you, without that, the room might only fit one double bed.
I would say one bed, potentially one double bed, maximum. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay. So you can paint them, and those spindles, they don't have to be there to keep a child in. They can just be a feature of
it. Because it is a very stylish feature, isn't it? Yeah.
All right. Okay.
I love that.
Now, up in a loft, an attic space.
Yeah.
It can often be difficult now without the high-pitched roof to have a bunk bed.
Yeah. So listen, this bunk bed is quite high. This is sitting above an entryway door. So if you have a big A-frame house with a really high ceiling, a vaulted ceiling, what this person has done, what this picture has, is a sitting room underneath. It looks like there's another bedroom underneath. Then there's a stairs against the wall, and they have built a kind of a mezzanine level bunk bed that is, you know, walled in. So it's very, very secure. There's quite a lot of privacy up there, I'd imagine.
There's a lot of building going on there and regulations I'm looking at.
That is, it's custom built for sure. Okay. Yeah, for sure.
Now, colour drenching. So we've looked at the green one there, which is four bunk beds, all painted the same thing. But actually, you can do that very simply just with the double bunk bed.
Of course you can.
Paint the ladder, paint the skirts, do the walls if you want.
Yeah. And then you can pick it up even more if you want to, with a pattern in the wallpaper, with a pattern in the rug, with the bedding. You know, that's pretty cute, I think.
Yeah. Now this one here that we're looking at, it's colour drenched. It's an ordinary bunk bed, but it's colour drenched in a baby blue.
And it's a lovely powdery blue.
It is.
I mean, it's a really sweet colour, isn't it?
But the contrast is nearly nautical. So you've got kind of stripes on the pillowcases and you've got kind of some kind of diamondy pattern on the wallpaper. So you're picking up the blue, but it doesn't look busy.
It doesn't look busy at all. It doesn't look busy at all. And there's a lovely little kind of square, larger pattern as well on the floor. So it's a lot of blue. It's in every, you know, element of the room, but it's very, very balanced by lovely white colour. Mm. And I think it works. I'd be happy to sleep in that room.
When it comes to design, because it can look as if it fills the whole room. So what are the elements we have to make sure to avoid it looking just cluttered?
It depends on the room. I mean, you're going to want to have maybe something coming up at least a little bit covering over the side of the bed, I think.
Okay.
Because you're going to have messy blankets. You're going to have, you know, maybe dolls or whatever it might be strewn on the bed.
Rail.
So I think a curtain rail or a panel that's coming up and covering the worst of that mess is really, really important. And then the rest, keeping it open, maybe an open ladder. And then I think if you have storage, for sure, maximize every bit. If there's stairs going up the side, put drawers in those stairs. If there's drawers at the bottom, just make sure that's all nice and covered, that there's space in that room to throw all the junk and then close it away and then off you go. Right. It's hiding the mess, really. It's not, it's, you know,
well,
pretending
we're
it's
all
not
for
there.
That. That's what we do here. We're all for that. Jenny Sheehan, thank you so much for that. Bunk beds. If you have bunk beds, folks, let us know. Send us a picture. Thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You'll find me on Instagram. And I'd love to see, I'm sure you did a lot better than me putting mine up, but I'd love to see what you have created. That is our full lid for today. That's all we have time for on the podcast this week. Hope you enjoyed that different mix of items. Until next week, when we do it all again, if you'd like to get in touch with us, it is thehomeshow@newstalk.com. My thanks to producer Aoife Breen. Stephen McLoone was on sound. We will be back next week and we look forward to your company then. And if you've missed any of the items or any of our shows, don't forget, they're all up on Pod.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan. Saturday at 5 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.